So I guess the question stated another way is the ketogenic diet optimal for exercise performance and gaining muscle? I would say no. But if you want to enhance body composition in regards to maximum fat loss and muscle retention, I would say that a modified ketogenic diet is probably superior for some people.
Hi everyone, welcome to Live Longer World. I am your host, Astha, and in this podcast, I speak with longevity scientists working to slow and reverse aging. To find all podcast episodes and other resources, go to my website, livelongerworld.com. To find the link to the show notes for this episode, check out the description below. You said you take a beta-hydroxybutyrate supplement. Is that to elevate your ketone bodies even more in addition to the modified keto diet you do?
Yeah, the diet that I follow is like it's actually pretty heavy in carbohydrates relative to a ketogenic diet because I'm eating a lot of cruciferous vegetables, a lot of Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, and berries. I have berries every night and a little bit of dark chocolate. I try to get some nuts too, maybe walnuts or almonds occasionally. But so my beta-hydroxybutyrate in the morning is really low, like 0.3, 0.2, something like that. But at throughout the day, it as my metabolism revs up, I'm usually about like one. But I like to get it up to one like in the morning. And I think that actually elevates beta-hydroxybutyrate enough with like a ketone electrolyte salt to start getting some of the signaling effects, the anti-inflammatory effects, the epigenetic effects even, and the signaling effects. So yeah, take there's different salts like on the market. You could do MCTs too. I don't take a ketone ester, although we tend to do a lot of research with them for different things. But there's a product called KetoStart. It has sodium, potassium, calcium, and magnesium. So it's in a formulation that you can consume enough that it doesn't cause GI upset and can get your ketones as high as like two if you want it. But I just take like a third of the packet in the morning. I can feel it. And then I take the rest of the packet like midday. And the ketones do give your brain a little bit of a kick and you feel it. I mix it. I'm a big proponent of creatine monohydrate. So I take ketone electrolytes with creatine monohydrate and acetyl L-carnitine. So on a keto diet, your body's transporting a lot of fat to the mitochondria. In kids, we tend to see carnitine depletion in kids, especially if they're not eating meat. So, and acetyl L-carnitine crosses the blood-brain barrier. It's kind of like people use it as a nootropic. Studies are being done on depression with it. So there's a lot of very interesting things. So it's one of the few supplements that I take. I'm trying to think of the supplements: so vitamin D, magnesium, creatine, beta-hydroxybutyrate salts. Melatonin, I do take at night. I know that's a bit controversial. And then NMN. So the ketogenic diet will elevate NAD plus, but I've been experimenting with a supplement that's nicotine mononucleotide with resveratrol. And I've used it on and off and trying to get an opinion about it. I think there's some benefits, especially with when I take a higher dose and I exercise, it gives me a second wind. So, and I think maybe the benefits may occur like you, the more you use it, the longer you use it. The particular product, it's called Verso, and I don't know like who the scientist is involved. I don't know if it's David Sinclair or what, if he has his own supplement line or whatever, but I've tried different things in the past and I used it and I was not very convinced, but my wife kept telling me that it was working. And she's not, she doesn't really, she doesn't have a favorable view of most supplements. So I took it. I said, I didn't notice anything, but then I doubled the dose because they were sending us a lot. And then I started swimming and I noticed that I didn't tell her at the time, but then I started taking it more. And I was like, yeah, I feel it, but only if I'm really pushing myself aerobically. So, I mean, for athletes and stuff, it might be interesting. And, you know, maybe if you're older in the 70s and 80s too, it might become more relevant to take an NAD supplement. And I know this is a very hot topic in longevity science.
Right. I think there's also some debate on it that it doesn't, most of the studies show that you know, it may not actually be having that many lifespan benefits, but I do know anecdotally, a lot of people will say, especially older people, that they feel more energetic. So
yeah.
I'm not sure, maybe that's something that works better in humans. Maybe it's placebo. Maybe it is working in some people. I have no idea.
I was skeptical. I sat on study sections in federal grants reviewing some of the mouse data and things like that, and was skeptical. But then more and more grants started coming in, and then I saw evidence that it was getting through the GI tract, through the liver, making it to the brain, having some interesting effects, you know, actually boosting brain tissue levels. And the critique has been, well, it gets to the liver, and but it doesn't get past. But then I'm thinking like, you know, elevating NAD in the liver is probably a good thing. I mean, the liver is like the master metabolic regulator. So keeping the liver healthy is probably one of the most important things. So it might be a good thing that you're, you know, through first pass metabolism, the liver is getting hit with a big dose of NAD. That might be an anti-aging strategy for the liver. But some of the new data is showing that, you know, it's getting into the muscles. And then I have friends that are doing NAD shots. Some of them are doing IV, some of them are injecting, and they're telling me that it's working. I haven't tried it yet, but a few of them I really believe, you know, because they don't make things up, and they've tried other things and said it didn't work. So I'm kind of curious. Although I think my NAD levels are probably pretty good. The ketogenic diet increases NAD. So you asked about the mechanisms of the ketogenic diet, and I chaired the American Epilepsy Special Interest Group on Dietary Therapies, and we had a speaker, Marwan Elliman, she was the first author on a paper review article that discussed NAD as the main mechanism behind the beneficial effects of the ketogenic diet. And there's pretty compelling evidence that the ketogenic diet induced increase in NAD is contributing to some of that therapeutic benefits.
Fascinating. Well, what biomarkers do you track?
Personally, and in our study too, I wear a continuous glucose monitor, so glycemic variability, so you can get directly know your average glucose. And then insulin, hemoglobin A1C, which is interesting to compare with average glucose, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, so hsCRP, triglycerides, and blood pressure is probably one that I've been, you know, really interested in lately. And I would love to have a continuous blood pressure monitor because I see how it changes under different circumstances. So glucose, ketones, and ketones through a breath ketone device, and blood ketones too. And yeah, actually I use a ZRT cardiometabolic kit. And we use this. We do some research with NASA in extreme environments, and these kits, you can actually just put blood on a card, and you don't need a phlebotomist. And then you can send it to the lab, just like a Quest Labs or LabCorp, and get data on that. And we're using that in our registered clinical trial to test continuous glucose monitoring as a behavioral tool to optimize metabolic health. So we're doing that now. We're using Levels software as a software that's kind of tracking and things like that. So that we're almost done with our second cohort. So we have some interesting data coming in. We presented some of it at Experimental Biology and at USF, and then at Metabolic Health Summit. We have some things. So yeah, I think the ones that are super important are glucose, ketones, if you're doing a ketogenic diet, insulin, hsCRP, triglycerides, LDL, HDL. So that's another thing we talk about, cholesterol, and blood pressure. I mean, that's kind of, and then of course I do a CBC, like I do a complete blood panel, you know, CBC, CMP, at least once a year. I like two or three times a year, I try to do it, but at least once a year, I always do that.
Okay, cool. Yeah. In terms of LDL, I guess, I think a common concern on ketogenic diets is that it would raise the LDL levels. Do you think that's a concern at all? Or do you think, I mean, something like ApoB or LPA is a better marker for just heart disease in general?
Yeah, we added ApoB to our panel because the cardiometabolic kit does not measure that. So we added ApoB, and that goes up too a little bit, but not as much. So I think LDL, I have to say that my LDL did skyrocket in the beginning, but everything else improved. So HDL went up. My HDL was in like the 80s, and that's really good. And my triglycerides went down like below 50s. I had one that was like 39 in the 40s. So triglycerides went down. But the persistently elevated LDL is a concern for people who have heart disease in their family. And also, if the other biomarkers are not going in the right direction. So if you have, if your glucose, hemoglobin A1C, triglycerides, if these things are not significantly improving and you have significantly elevated LDL as a consequence of a ketogenic diet, you need to make some changes. I would recommend, cautiously recommend. And some changes that you can make is actually switching out, I reduce my dairy fat intake and animal protein, animal fat derived, saturated fat to more monounsaturated fat, a lot of fish, a lot of extra virgin olive oil, and MCTs, which is a saturated fat. But I think, when I first started doing the ketogenic diet, I was getting a lot of butter, heavy cream, and dairy fat. And just simply reducing that and eating a lot more fish, like just omega-3s alone. So say you did nothing else but just started like mega dosing omega-3, you would see some improvements in your lipid profile across the board, including LDL. And yeah, I mean, I don't think like eating a ribeye steak, 2 pounds of ribeye steak every day is going to, is probably, I know people are doing that and they're getting benefits from that. And there's probably, if you're equating for calories and your body composition is good and everything, you're probably not doing that much harm, but I don't think it's optimal. So, right, I don't think it's optimal. So if we want optimal biomarkers, I think it would be wise and prudent to or try, attempt to prevent a decrease in LDL with a ketogenic diet. And in the beginning, I was thinking maybe 15% of people experience this, but I think it's more like 50 or 60%. Based upon the research that we're doing. And there are different strategies that you can do. Just getting more plant-based fiber in, getting, like I said, monounsaturated fats, keeping saturated fat, of all your fat, keeping it like 20 to 25% or less is one thing that you can do. And, even eggs, I'm a big fan of, replacing some meat with eggs. I've been doing that lately, and I give some of the like the yolks to my dogs a lot, so I've been eating a little bit. But an egg yolk is really oleic acid. It's not even that really high in saturated fat. So, and eating a lot of smaller fish, is something that I do too. I know as a vegetarian, you probably don't eat that, but I do like sardines and oysters and mackerel and things like that. And I've replaced some of my meat with more fish and I don't even think I had any meat today yet, but usually like at dinner we'll do like some kind of meat or fish or something like that. But I've had like eggs throughout the day. More eggs. So we have free range chickens and stuff running around. So
That's amazing.
I have
Where
access
is
to
your
that.
farm?
We're in the middle, we're in like Plant City, Florida. And yeah, we have like 8 cows and they're just, it's kind of like a hobby farm, but it's kind of growing into, and we have like a pond, which was a fish farm. So I'm renovating it and I want to do like more of a regenerative farm. It's like my retirement project. I've been working on that. So
That's
that's
awesome.
what I do on the weekends.
Before I dive into some other questions, more common questions people have on ketogenic diets, one question before I forget. The beta hydroxybutyrate supplement you mentioned, do you just take that without food in the mornings?
Yeah, my routine is like wake up, drink a big glass of water, and then I get my coffee brewing. I'm a big fan of coffee too, but I don't go too overboard with it. And then I mix like a third of a packet of keto starch with some like 3 grams of creatine monohydrate. which is a good supplement for strength, and some acetyl L-carnitine. And then I mix that up and it tastes really good. And then I drink that. And then I take the dogs out, let the cows out, walk around barefoot, get some sun, get some sunshine, and then, for 15 minutes or so, come back in, get my coffee. And then I put, without eating anything, and then I put something in my coffee called Keto Brains, which is MCT oil powder. It's got lion's mane, alpha GPC, and theanine in it. So theanine is sort of a GABA based, amino acid. So, and then w mixed with the coffee, it's good. It takes like the jitters away from caffeine and you're very focused. And then on days where I need to get a lot done, I just have that little spike of ketones with the electrolytes and then the creatine. And then I come in and I have my coffee and then I can just bang out a lot of work for like 4 to 6 hours, right? And then sometimes then I'll eat my first meal. Or I'll come in, I'll have my coffee and then I'll cook breakfast. And lately I've been eating more breakfast, and I just do intermittent fasting maybe once or twice a week, something like that. But I like to sit down with my wife and have breakfast and have dinner. And for breakfast, I'll have, actually I've been making these waffles, which are like eggs. And I just mix some eggs and like mozzarella cheese together into a batter and put it in this little convenient waffle maker, and you just pour it in, and it just magically makes these waffles. And I've been kind of eating them. And but yeah, I'm okay. The things when you are adapted, when you're fat adapted, and you follow a ketogenic diet for a period of time, or if you just do intermittent fasting, when you're fasting, it doesn't become a crisis if you go without food. So I think that's a significant advantage to being fat adapted. But I do experience really good benefits with a ketone supplement. So I'll add that. And I think the science is very nascent, but I think, there's like 50 clinical trials already, which surprised me on ketone supplements. And I think there's a lot of potential in these compounds. I think there's a lot of work that we need to do to develop the optimal formulation because the current ketone salts that are on the market, they have questionable purity, they have questionable potency, and they have very questionable tolerability that you drink them and then you have to run to the bathroom. So that's why the KetoStart product has like an electrolyte array similar to another product that I really like called Element. It's LMNT. It's like an electrolyte. So Rob Wolf makes it. And then the electrolyte blend is very much the same, but the electrolytes are bound to ketones. So you're delivering the electrolytes and delivering ketones, beta hydroxybutyrate, at a pretty high concentration. And like I don't take a whole package, just a third of the pack, I feel it, and then I do the other two thirds later on in the afternoon. So that has become one of my staple supplements. And but I used to take tons of different supplements, but now I've narrowed it down to vitamin D, maybe magnesium at night. And then melatonin. I do think there's a lot of benefits to melatonin for sleep. I did melatonin as a postdoctoral fellow where I put it into solution with hippocampal brain slices and I saw that it decreased oxygen-free radicals and basically kept the hippocampus very healthy under conditions that would otherwise kill the neuron. So that made me kind of a believer in this when you do the research. And I think it's a very good antioxidant. So I don't take it necessarily as a sleep supplement, although I take it during the day. I'm also in touch with patients that are using like 1 to 2 grams of melatonin, not milligrams, like grams of melatonin for an anti-cancer effect. So these are cancer patients who more or less are effectively managing their cancer, and their melatonin at a high dose has anti-cancer effects and some other interesting properties. So, and they're not sleepy. So one of the things I actually say it has like a serotonin effect. They feel happy, they feel good. I think you're well past the dosage. You're saturating the receptors and everything. But they became, because I never heard of people taking such a high
These are
dose.
cancer patients.
These are cancer patients. Yeah, there's groups of cancer patients, and then they send me papers, and I was reading the papers, and I was like, there's pretty good scientific rationale for the anti-cancer effects of melatonin. So, I communicated with them. I was like, well, how do you feel? And they said, well, and these are a couple now. So first, and one patient in particular that I talk to quite often, actually goes by the name of Naples Dave. So you can look him up on Instagram and check him out, because he has a, you know, his prognosis was not very good, and he's pretty, he's effectively managing his cancer with ketogenic diet, fasting, and incorporating also the standard of care. And actually he used exogenous ketones too, which is kind of interesting. But I know his doctor at the Moffitt Cancer Center, and it's a remarkable case. And I think it's actually worthy of maybe a case report. So, so yeah. And then, you know, there's just people that are taking megadosing melatonin. It's something, it's a supplement that I've used since graduate school. So 25 years I've been using it, and I don't see any negative effects from it. And I think there's good health benefits and brain longevity benefits to using melatonin.
You should talk to Dr. Sachin Panda about it. If I remember correctly, I believe I heard him say that he is not a huge fan of it because it disrupts your circadian rhythm and also leads to, I think, glucose spikes. So yeah, I'm not sure about that.
We talked about it a little bit. I brought it up in a recent interview that I did with him. I'm not sure if they posted it yet on the YouTube page, but so he was mostly not a fan of melatonin because of the potential for circadian disruption. So if the, and you know, and and he's very right that the dose of melatonin is like 5 or 10 milligrams now, where it should really be like 500 micrograms. But on conversely, you have people taking 1,000 milligram or 5,000 milligram. You're taking gram, like, you know, getting the raw powder and scooping it, and they're feeling great. All their biomarkers are great. And then, you know, I don't, I'm mostly interested in melatonin, not affected to circadian, and they're sleeping great too, from my understanding. But my interest in melatonin is as a neuroprotective antioxidant compound that crosses the blood-brain barrier and gets into the mitochondria and into the brain. I think it has remarkable effects there, and the anti-cancer effects too, in particular for breast cancer and stuff. So I'm actually pushing my wife to, you know, take it more prophylactically, but she's not, doesn't want to take any kind of pills, you know. She's, and I agree with her. I think the most important thing to do for sleep and circadian is to get out in the sun early in the morning, get, you know, bright light in your face, and but you don't want to overdo sun too. But I'm a big fan of the sun. We live in Florida, so I try to get it early in the morning, and just, I kind of do work during the day, but I keep my office, you know, keep a window right by my desk. I think that's important.
Okay. So what about ketogenic diet for women? Because I think some people are a little iffy about it, especially, I know personally for me, especially before I start my menstrual cycle, I have way more carb craving. So it's much harder for me to practice it back then. But in general, like, is there data that it affects the two sexes, men and women, differently?
Yeah, I think the suppression of the hormone insulin can alter female physiology in ways that males don't experience. And one thing, I mean, in women that are lactating, if they become totally unable to, you know, breastfeed if they're on a low carb ketogenic diet, so they have to incorporate carbs. So I know personally some females like that. And if you look at the only really good data we have with female solid data, we have females with it, our true ketogenic diet is in the world of epilepsy. And in that case, some adolescent females become amenorrheic. And so there's like, I think the data was a 5 times higher chance of getting amenorrhea. But if you really look at the data, it appeared that it was the protein restriction too was part of that. So maybe a more modified diet, modified Atkins type diet and higher protein, and that would have not been the case. So I do think that females, if they do follow a ketogenic diet, it's probably more important for them to get adequate protein, like 20% of their diet to protein, and not like 10% protein, or not like, not a clinical ketogenic diet. So to ensure that they get, the problem with females that I've communicated with over the years is that they start a ketogenic diet, they start an exercise program, and then they'd like intermittent fast at the same time. So it's like they're doing all these interventions. So the combination of carbohydrate restriction, very low insulin, over-exercising with calorie restriction, their hormones go through the floor, they stop menstruating, they're over-exercising. So I think this is largely a result of a calorie deficit, and which is exercising will produce more of a calorie deficit. And but if you get sufficient amount of calories, sufficient amount of protein, and you're not overtraining, I see little chance of any hormonal effects unless you're doing like a very regimented clinical ketogenic diet. Could be a possibility for that, but you don't know unless you test. So I think it's more important for women to do just an overall hormone profile. Look at thyroid, look at LH, FSH, look at, do a hormone profile, maybe more important for women. But I look at my hormones. I do salivary hormones and blood hormones, and everything's pretty much normal. My DHEA was trending a little bit low, so I do take, I don't do like testosterone replacement therapy or anything like that, but I do take a dose of DHEA first thing in the morning. So that's another supplement that I take. And then that definitely brought my DHEA up, and everything else is like, within a good range. So, and I'm not super young. So, so things I know just many people, guys, especially in the fitness world, that are on hormone replacement therapy, testosterone, and they're like in their 30s and 40s. So I don't want to go that route for a long time. So I think, I get a lot of questions about the ketogenic diet, increasing testosterone, decreasing testosterone. It didn't really have any effect on me, as long I know that fasting will decrease my time. And that's why I capped my fasting to 3 days when I did 5 days or 7 days. Definitely suppressed my hormones. So, and it took some time for it to recover. So, but with 3 days seems to be the sweet spot. I can get deep into ketosis, probably get a lot of the benefits without disrupting my hormones.
And what about pregnant women? Is it safe for them to be on a ketogenic diet?
Yeah, I definitely would not go out on a limb and say, hey, it's fine. But conversely, I've been in contact with a number of women who contacted me and said, I went full term. I was in a state of high ketones the whole time. I don't think it's optimal. I think the growing fetus, probably it's good to do a mixed diet. Some women gain too much weight, during pregnancy. So I think one way to moderate that weight gain is simply to, restrict your carbohydrates. But I think a lower carb, maybe moderate protein, moderate fat diet, just a mixed diet, eliminate process. But I think you need to be very much more cautious about what you're eating when you're pregnant, because a developing fetus is very sensitive to environmental toxins. So, you probably don't want to be eating, fish every day. So, but then again, things like I eat a lot of sardines, and Joe Rogan told me that he was eating sardines and his arsenic was off the chart.
Right.
So immediately I come home and I was like, okay, I did the hair test, I did blood test. So everything was within normal range. Mercury, arsenic, all that stuff, was in normal range. And if anything, I was eating massive amounts of fish during that time, like eating, traveling lots of sardines and things like that. So if there was heavy metals or other contaminant in my fish, it would have showed up on there. Although when I was in grad school, I was eating those big cans of tuna that you get from Sam's, and I think maybe I was getting some effects. I was losing more hair, but maybe my testosterone. But I saw some effects, and one of my professors was like, "I don't." It wasn't. I didn't take it as a critique, but she was like, "Hey, you're eating a lot of tuna, and you tend to be losing some hair there." And she's like, "I had a friend that was, eating a lot of swordfish and things, and she started, it was a female, she started losing her hair." And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I like started eating more salmon, I think, at the time or whatever. But looking back, I was eating way too much tuna fish. I was on a super high protein diet, and I think maybe I was maybe getting some signs of mercury toxicity looking back, but I never knew to measure back then.
Does
I
that
wasn't
cause
into
hair loss?
measuring.
Is mercury toxicity connected to hair loss?
Well, It can be, I think, under some circumstances, but she sent me some papers on it or something like that, but I'm not totally convinced. But I think the important thing is, the question was about pregnancy, and I think you need to be much more cautious about the quality of your food when you're pregnant or you're breastfeeding. I know I would be, like, having studied like developmental biology and neurobiology and things like that. Like, we live on a farm, there's like lots of glyphosate being used, which is Roundup and other chemicals and things like that. And when we bought the place, started looking through all the chemicals and thinking, wow, I would be very, if my wife was pregnant or something, and I would be very cautious and very concerned about living on a farm. And I grew up on farms, spraying chemicals and things like that. And looking back, I would be very cautious in with females that are pregnant in that certain situation. So, but I don't see any particular concerns with a ketogenic diet, if that's, but I don't think it's ideal. I don't think there's like serious safety concerns. I would not advise it, but I would advise maybe a lower carbohydrate diet if you have a propensity to gain weight, during pregnancy. It's one way to moderate it.
And what about children? Do you think they need higher carbs or can they be on a modified keto, low carb diet?
Well, we have a obesity problem with children now, so I think the biggest thing to target is calorie-containing liquids like high fructose corn syrup, sodas, and things like that. So that's like the low-hanging fruit that we need to eliminate. But processed carbs are a big problem. Lower carb diets, I think, can be very beneficial for kids that have like ADHD and attention deficit disorder and things like that. I know that because I've communicated with quite a few parents, and some of them even sending me videos before and after of their behavior, their kids, some of them sending report cards showing like, their scores are higher after doing what they're calling a ketogenic diet. But when I find out what they're really eating, it's more just like no sugar, no processed carbs, just lower carb, but not necessarily ketogenic. And in the world of epilepsy too, like cognitive function increases with, if you're not having seizures, you tend to have better behavior, better learning and memory and things like that. So in the world of epilepsy, we know that kids do well on a ketogenic diet, and they tend to do better cognitively too.
And I believe
Whether
that
that
some.
translates to, normal, healthy kids, probably not. But for kids that have the beginning of obesity, and we have kids now with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and they would be good candidates, I think, for if not ketogenic diet, just a lower carb diet.
Which makes me think, do you think there's a genetic component to it as well? Like people respond differently to ketogenic diets based on their genes?
Yeah, I collaborated with Lucia Aronica on a review article, and Dr. Jeff Volek was on it too, that people can have a variety of different SNPs where they have impaired fatty acid oxidation enzymes and even like ketolytic enzymes and things that would make them more susceptible to a higher fat intake. So there are definitely people that I've communicated with that had fat intolerance, that felt sick on a ketogenic diet, they got hypoglycemic, they could not, they're few and far between, but I think most people, if they give it time, can adapt to a ketogenic diet. But for some people, it's hard to put a number to it, 10, 50%, they almost have a violent response to the higher fat. So with our study we're doing now, Dr. Allison Hull at Florida Medical Clinic is sort of the clinician running the study. What she does, and she's learned through, a vast amount of experience, is to transition a person to a ketogenic diet over like 4 to 6 weeks. If they're at 200, 300 grams of carbs, you bring them down to 100, and then gradually to 8 to 75, 50, 25, and then you titrate it depending upon the individual to achieve an elevation of ketones, and then that's a little bit different for each patient, but that's the best way to do it to ensure adaptation to prevent side effects. And also, if they have a bad experience out of the gate, they're likely not going to follow through with the 12-week, intervention that we have. So, or sustain the diet to produce that sustained weight loss, which is really producing the beneficial effects of weight loss.
That's a good point. When I initially started the ketogenic diet, it was actually during COVID. And I completely cut out my carbs. And I the next day I woke up and I thought I was dying. I felt so sick. But I eventually adapted and it was fine.
The same happens with like intermittent fasting. So you can kind of enhance that metabolic switching, which is a term Dr. Mark Mattson uses, the metabolic switch. So one way to help you adapt to a ketogenic diet is to do like low carb intermittent fasting and then gradually titrate your carbohydrates down. And I think it could be not completely painless, but it can be much more tolerable for most people to do it in that way, a more gradual way. I didn't do it that way. I just went right into like, I got Dr. Freeman and Dr. Kossoff's book and was like, I bought the scale. At the time, I bought the blood ketone meter, which was like really crazy expensive at the time. I forget the name of the company, but it was like, I went full steam into it and kind of got sick and lost a lot of strength. But after about 3 or 4 weeks, I was like, oh, okay, I see what you're talking about. Like I started feeling the benefits and then I didn't get hungry. And that was very odd for me. I was very much into food to not be hungry. It was kind of a little strange to not be hungry all the time. Then I realized, oh, I'm going into a tenure track faculty position. And if I can not be hungry, I can get more work done and I can, not have to be, I can leverage it to my advantage. And I was reading so much about ketones, I was really believing, like, wow, if I get my ketones elevated, then I'll just be much more productive and happy overall. So I think a lot of the benefits that I talk about with being in ketosis came as a result of the belief that ketones were magical and that they're going to do. And I think to some extent they are. And I think that's why I take small amounts of exogenous ketones because they do offer real world benefits. But I think a lot of my initial enthusiasm and, advocacy of this was just through just being very compelled by the science. And this was Dr. Richard Veach at the time, Dr. George Cahill, who did research on like fasting, Dr. Mark Mattson. I think he had published that beta hydroxybutyrate was enhancing learning and memory because it was the molecule that when you fast, beta hydroxybutyrate goes up and that works through BDNF to enhance long-term potentiation and memory and things like that. So I was reading all these papers and doing the diet and experiencing these benefits. And I think half of my enthusiasm for this was I was very excited to be able to, to be in a faculty position, to do what I love, and to make this part of my, academic research program. That was part of it too. And I had students that it's much better when you have students that are sincerely enthusiastic and interested in what you're doing, And instead of studying like a drug or some kind of esoteric pathway with a diet, once you get results, it's like it has like real world applicability. So you can talk about it and like people get interested in it, as
Right.
opposed to like, some weird drug affecting KRAS for like cancer or something like that. So, but we do drug research, we do metformin research. And I know you had a
Dr.
person
Niebuhr as
on
well
talking
on
about.
it. Right.
Yeah, I have, a student of mine did his whole project just on metformin and so we do drug research too. It's just most of what we do is ketogenic interventions.
What was the research on metformin?
Yeah, so we looked at the mechanism of metformin. So metformin does suppress cancer, like in our, so we looked at, AMP kinase, but mostly what we discovered is that metformin is working through complex one of the mitochondria. And it actually functions as like a weak mitochondrial toxin. So it actually increases reactive oxygen species. And that may contribute to, maybe some of the anti-cancer effects, but it has through the mitochondrial electron transport chain, it has sort of a weak mitochondrial toxicity associated with that is associated with some of the anti-cancer effects that we saw in the lab. And maybe I was interested in melatonin. I mean, I was interested in metformin as a longevity drug. And, our discovery was that it was sort of functioning as a mild mitochondrial toxin in a way. And I no doubt that it activates AMP kinase too. And we didn't see a very big, I was very interested to see a reduction in glucose. We didn't really see that in the mice. There was a trend towards it, but it wasn't really that significant. And I think if you have really high glucose, metformin can bring it down by enhancing insulin sensitivity, maybe through AMP kinase. But the main effect that we saw that it was kind of working to increase, mitochondrial reactive oxygen species, and it was kind of working through this mechanism.
So when you did the experiments on metformin, was it that metformin was given to mice who had cancer or just given to both groups, and the mice that had metformin didn't develop cancer versus the others did?
Yeah, we used the VMM3 model of metastatic cancer, and it decreased, tumor burden over time. So it gave the mice like a little bit of a longevity advantage. And we also looked at another drug called DCA, dichloroacetate, which activates PDH. We're pretty enthusiastic that that was going to produce an effect too, based upon some literature, but I think it had like little or no effect on our model. It was a pretty mild effect, whereas metformin had a pretty nice effect on it. And we didn't like couple metformin with other interventions. I think maybe I wanted my student to at the time, but he was mostly interested in drugs and not so much the diet. So we just did metformin with a standard diet, and it had an effect similar to a modified ketogenic diet, not quite as much, but and we never did a study where we like combined like metformin, ketone supplementation, ketogenic diet, hyperbaric oxygen. Like I wanted to, because some patients are doing this too, and it would be nice to do that. But I think if you throw too many things in, you don't know what's working. But we have kind of already studied each thing individually, so I think it would be nice to go back and combine like 2-deoxyglucose, ketogenic diet, metformin, hyperbaric oxygen therapy. One of my students did vitamin C for her undergraduate honors thesis, which was pretty nice data. Then she went to Oxford and did a master's there, and now she's at the Moffitt Cancer Center just right across the street doing some nice work. But I kind of wanted her to come and do her PhD on vitamin C. So maybe I'll revisit that project too. And because intravenous vitamin C, very interesting to me, because vitamin C in millimolar concentrations becomes a prooxidant. So you can drive the Fenton reaction and actually, enhance oxidative stress in tumors by delivering. Vitamin C also uses the same transporter as glucose. So it becomes a glucose antagonist. If you get vitamin C up very high, it blocks glucose transport, and that can be beneficial to cancer cells that are need a high amount of glucose. We are very interested in combining many of these approaches to develop a comprehensive, non-toxic, metabolic-based therapy for cancer. I mean, this is sort of a big motivation of myself and the entire lab. Many people come to my lab because they're very interested in testing these drug therapies like metformin, DCA, 2-deoxyglucose, but also like these dietary therapies too, and more integrative. I don't like to use the word alternative, but integrative approaches like IV vitamin C. And I had a student that was interested in EGCG and turmeric and curcumin, and I think there's a rationale for looking at these things too. And we want to do that. We're going to start looking at these compounds.
I wonder if a lot of these compounds, say metformin, for example, have benefits once you already have cancer versus actually preventing cancer. Like if I'm just a healthy person, I'm not is there any data that metformin can prevent cancer versus like if I have cancer that maybe it will suppress the tumor a little more?
Yeah, some of the most compelling data came out on people with type 2 diabetes. So if you have type 2 diabetes and you were using metformin for a protracted period of time, if you go back retrospectively and look at the data, in particular, I remember pancreatic cancer, something like 60%, decrease in the likelihood of getting pancreatic cancer if you have type 2 diabetes, you are at a much higher risk of getting like liver cancer, gallbladder cancer, pancreatic cancer for women, endometrial cancer, I think, stomach cancer, things like that. So, but in type 2 diabetic patients that were using metformin, their likelihood of getting pancreatic cancer was significantly reduced. It was more than 50%, I think maybe like 60%. So, so that data, I remember that was some of the data that got me interested in actually studying metformin and other compounds. So I think 2-deoxyglucose, 3-bromopyruvate, which inhibits hexokinase 2, is something very interesting. Although the whole story behind that's a little bit, there's an interesting story behind that. And Dr. Ko at Johns Hopkins spearheaded a lot of very interesting research behind that. And it's a molecule that needs to be delivered in a very precise way to avert the liver toxicity that could be associated with that. But it's a very powerful anti-cancer therapy that if we harness that and maybe couple it with other modalities, it could be very effective.
Okay. Well, a couple of last questions on ketogenic diets. What is the connection between ketogenic diets and helping with Alzheimer's disease, or even with people who have an ApoE4 carrier?
Good question. So there was some research showing that MCT oil, it was a compound that Xera made, it was called AC1202, that actually kind of got me interested in MCTs. Then this compound was used in some subjects that had mild cognitive impairment or early Alzheimer's disease, onset Alzheimer's disease, and the benefit was dependent upon the elevation of ketones, but not in subjects that were ApoE4 positive, right? So, so the ApoE4 positive subjects were, but it was a very small trial. But I think in a bigger study, if you were to look at this, I don't think that would be the case. So I'm kind of going out on a limb on that. But I think there was work, a number of studies that have been done by different investigators, including Dr. Stephen Kunin. You might want to have him on. He did studies looking at brain energy metabolism, looking at a glucose PET scan and then a ketone PET scan. And for subjects that had mild cognitive impairment over time, you see glucose hypometabolism is a hallmark characteristic of Alzheimer's disease or even cognitive impairment. So it's been termed type 3 diabetes by some. So this is generally accepted and it's not really known why. Does the metabolic impairment lead to the formation of the amyloid and tau plaques over time? Is it the what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of scenario, right? So I do think with Alzheimer's disease, there's a metabolic phenotype, meaning that for people who have Alzheimer's disease and have this metabolic phenotype, they are very responsive to a metabolic intervention, meaning, an elevation of ketone bodies delivered with a ketogenic diet or a ketone ester can produce remarkable improvements in cognitive function, reaction time, brain energy metabolism, that sort of thing. So I would say that Steve Newport, who is the husband of Dr. Mary Newport, she wrote a book about Alzheimer's disease and ketones, and really highlighting the work of the late Dr. Richard Veitch, who developed one of the first ketone esters, which was actually used in a case report that was published, and he was the subject of that. And I had the opportunity to meet, you know, Steve Newport when he was still alive and with Mary, and I witnessed him consume MCT oil, and he became more animated. His tremors stopped. He was starting to get tremors at the time. He had pretty advanced Alzheimer's disease at the time. So this was like 2008 or nine. And it was one of the things that actually motivated me at a very gut level that this is something, you know, this person was not speaking and he had tremors. He just consumed this oil that was in a little vial. And in 15 minutes, he became talkative and his tremors stopped. So, and he was not really following keto. He was doing a low carb diet, but he was not really on a ketogenic diet. So what he consumed was coconut oil and MCT oil. It's like 30 or 40 milliliters. And I remember this because Dr. Mary Newport came to me and she was a guest speaker at the College of Aging for this class I was teaching. So I invited her. I was like, hey, do you want to speak too about your observations? And then we went out to eat. And then I witnessed this, and then I started reading more and talking with her. And this actually influenced the trajectory of my career. And I became more interested in studying ketogenic diet, not only for seizures, but we actually got a project started up at the Bird Alzheimer's Center at University of South Florida, which was funded by the Alzheimer's Association. It was a mouse study, and they also funded a human clinical trial with coconut oil and MCT oil, but it was hard to recruit subjects for that trial because they realized that they could just go to the nutrition store and buy MCT oil or coconut oil and not have the problem of having a placebo, you know? Right. And it was like, well, if it's working, you know, the subjects don't want to be consuming a placebo. They could just go, it wasn't like a drug, you know, they could go to the store. So it was difficult to recruit for that trial. I feel like the center really didn't market and try to recruit for it. So I don't know. That's another whole story. There's kind of a big push for drug research, but long story short. Yeah. So with Alzheimer's disease, I do think that many people, glucose hypometabolism is a hallmark, and quite a few patients will respond positively to a metabolic intervention. And if you are ApoE4 positive, the important thing is a ketogenic diet may not be totally optimal. I think a low carb diet that's rich in phytonutrients, you know, I'm a big fan of coffee, green tea, turmeric, kale, parsley, cocoa, you know, walnuts, all these things, you know, and some of these things are not ketogenic, but having a good balanced, healthy diet, and then with ketone supplementation and omega-3s and maybe some supplements like alpha-GPC and, you know, different brain boosting nootropic supplements may offer some advantage too. So even different mushroom compounds like lion's mane could be helpful. There's a company called First Person that I'm a big fan of, and they create different mushroom-based compounds that are kind of nootropic too. And I think there's a lot of emerging evidence for some of these compounds too.
And you think these could be preventative as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the science is not there yet, but I do think that anything that keeps your heart and metabolic health, you know, optimized is going to help your brain. So we know that. So blood pressure, glucose, you know, inflammation, like, you know, focus on that. And then your brain, it'll pay big dividends for your brain later on. And then physical exercise, but also training your brain, like actually doing mental exercises, reading, and not talked about much, but social engagement, you know, actually building healthy relationships, social interaction, things like that. My wife's a big fan of dancing, and she thinks that, like, you know, we have friends that have a tango studio, and they actually observe that Parkinson's disease patients, when put in that atmosphere and they dance, it's like very therapeutic. And it's like, so that's whole interesting area of research. So you have music, which is like cognitive stimulation, and it like changes your whole state, elevates dopamine. And then you're dancing, which is physical movement, and then you have social interaction stuff too. And the more I think about it, the more I was like, let's design a study where we give people ketones and then they can dance and do these complicated dance routines to music, and then you have social interaction. So I'm thinking
That
there's
would be
something
cool.
here.
I had this idea a few years ago as well, where, what if we did combine, say, exercise with music and maybe some sort of social interaction for just mental health or mental disorders or even mild forms of depression? I honestly think it could have such a good effect instead of taking medication for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm totally a fan of doing all that and even doing it like outside in the sun
Right.
with animals. So animal, like we have
Basically
cows
come
and
to
they're
your
like,
farm.
we have Brahman cows, which are like the best cows, right? And so it's like the holy cow. Yeah, and
Yeah.
these are like amazing animals that you don't do any, you just give them a nice field with grass and treat them well, but we have them trained so they're just like pets. And for my wife, it's very therapeutic for her. And I'll have to say that I could take a break during work and go out and just hang out with the cows, and it's very calming. So they're just amazing animals. So yeah, I think there's a lot of underutilized resources and ideas that I think we can implement for brain health and therapies for people.
Yeah. One last question. Keto and exercise. I mean, you clearly, you I think lift a lot, you exercise a lot, you mentioned. I know once you've mentioned you did like a 500-pound deadlift after 7 days of fasting. So
Oh
it's
yeah,
clearly
Tim Ferriss
possible.
mentioned
But is it optimal for people to be on a ketogenic diet when they are exercising heavily or is, yeah.
Well, so I guess the question stated another way is the ketogenic diet optimal for exercise performance and gaining muscle? I would say no. But if you want to enhance body composition in regards to maximum fat loss and muscle retention, I would say that a modified ketogenic diet is probably superior for some people. So to get around your question, not to be like try to avert the question, but I think for a large majority of people who are, and many people exercise to lose weight, right? So I think you'll have more favorable body composition alterations with exercise if you do a modified form of a ketogenic diet. You'll just get results faster. And I don't, if your protein is adequate and sufficient, you're not going to risk muscle loss if you get your protein in. And you don't have to go crazy with protein, but I think you do need to get it up to a certain level, about, 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram to really keep your muscle on. And if you're vegetarian, that's not hard. If you can get eggs in, if you're vegan, if you want to, that's another whole thing. And that's you really need to think about combining, different plant sources. But we do have plant proteins on the market that could be helpful for that. Didn't mean to go down like the whole plant-based thing, but I do think a ketogenic diet can be used, and whether it's optimal. I'm in contact with professional athletes, that are using this, from football players to, hockey players and baseball players and things like that that are using a ketogenic diet. So I know it's possible to be
How
a very
long does it,
high level.
yeah, but how long does it take your body to adapt to it? Because I know from just my personal experience, when I initially started the ketogenic diet, it took me maybe at least 2 months or so to get my performance back to where I was before the ketogenic diet. So can athletes afford it if there's an adaptation period?
Yeah, that's the feedback is about 2 or 3 months, but I tell you, I think, over the course of a year, you're still getting adaptations. And
Oh,
the more
right.
you do it and the more you follow it, the more benefits you'll derive and the more adaptations that you'll get from it. So I think, you kind of like many things in life, you get out of it what you put into it, and the more time and effort, and there's a learning curve to doing the diet and tracking it and ensuring that you're actually in ketosis. I know there was for me, and I felt like I know more than most people about it, but it was still quite a bit of a learning curve to do it right.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. All right. What else? Questions that I haven't covered, asked you, other areas of research that you're excited about? I know we covered a few that your lab is exploring, but maybe something else we haven't touched upon and you're quite excited about.
Yeah, you know, I'm very interested in this idea of an endogenous metabolite, beta-hydroxybutyrate, or maybe acetoacetate too, being a therapeutic and being able to consume this as a supplement or a compound that can dose dependently elevate this endogenous metabolite to trigger signaling effects that could be anti-inflammatory processes, or what we're really focusing on now is like neuroregenerative, neuroprotective things and epigenetic things. So we're looking at epigenetic pathways. So we're in the process now of, you know, developing methods for histone extraction, you know, looking at histone modifications, looking at, you know, re-regulating histone modifications, improving gene expression patterns, increasing double cortin and neurogenesis. Like we have animal models where we're looking at that. So, and then, you know, we're doing behavioral studies where we're looking at increasing and enhancing learning capacity, you know, learning and memory, but also improving like behavior, like anxiety behaviors and things like that, and reversing that. So I'm pretty excited about that. And also the expanding field of metabolic psychiatry. So before we go into our metabolic health summit, which is coming up in about a month, we have a conference that's happening just prior to that with some key investigators that are studying the effects of ketogenic diet on psychiatric conditions. And it includes like depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder, where the ketogenic diet appears to be very efficacious in helping patients. So this had been reported and actually being studied by a number of key people. One of them is from Stanford, that Dr. Shivani will be from Stanford is kind of investigating this, and several NIH-funded investigators will be coming together to talk about this. So I'm very excited about the future of nutrition as a metabolic intervention that can help with psychiatric disorders too. What's interesting in the case of like bipolar disorder is that the go-to treatments are actually anti-seizure drugs. Many anti-seizure drugs are actually used as medication to help manage the manic phase of bipolar disorder. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, the ketogenic therapies can help to manage patients that have bipolar. And Dr. Chris Palmer was a speaker at our event and will be a speaker this year too. And he's at Harvard and he's had a number of patients that he has helped. And I became aware of his work. And I think I would like to bring more attention to this idea of improving mental health and actually treating psychiatric conditions with a ketogenic diet.
Oh, that actually is a really exciting idea and field. Cause I wonder if it's just so many things happening, right? Maybe your brain is just calmer, but also maybe if you're just cutting out the processed food and sugar, you might just feel better. You're more active. I do hope. Yeah. It becomes.
It's part of it. Prevalent. I mean, we know from epilepsy that you're changing the neuropharmacology of your brain, whether dopamine and serotonin are involved. I don't know. We haven't looked into that, but adenosine is definitely elevated, like 2 or 3-fold higher. And then GABA to glutamate ratio. GABA is significantly elevated relative to glutamate. So I think GABA can have a calming effect, you know, anxiolytic effect. This is like, without question, we see that. I measured my own neurotransmitters and saw that too. I wanted to make sure our mouse data was happening in myself too. So yeah, I think that's kind of on the horizon, and it's an area of research that I'm very excited to be part of, the use of nutrition to impact metabolic psychiatry. This whole field, I think, will advance quite a bit in the next couple of years.
And there's just, I just thought of this, and maybe there's no study or you don't know about this, but could you maybe combine, say, psychedelic research with the ketogenic research and ketogenic endogenous, exogenous ketones? Like, do you think that would help as well?
Yeah, I in the past I'm kind of hesitant to talk about psychedelic research, but the more I connect with people that are using some of these, mushroom compounds, the more I'm starting to get very interested in it. And I would encourage people to go to the website First Person, and they're developing, for right now, it's like compounds that can be used as nootropic, from lion's mane to reishi to shaga, and different things, cordyceps, mushrooms. But I know they're working to advance this idea of developing a particular strain of psilocybin for microdosing, and then microdosing compounds for mental health, for depression, for anxiety. The people behind it actually brought to my attention they had a father that their father was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. And in the later stages, they had given him, I hope it's okay to make this public, but they had given him some psilocybin, and they saw remarkable effects. He became animated. He could do things that he otherwise couldn't do. And I thought, well, that information should get out. And I think that motivated them to sort of start the company. I think initially it was called Leo Wellness, but now it's First Person. I think it's like they're it's like Get First Person, maybe the website. But if you Google search it, you'll find it. And they have developed some very interesting formulations that can be consumed in the morning to enhance like dopamine in the later, mid part of the day for serotonin, then at nighttime to help, with sleeping or calming you down. And then I know they are working to advance this idea of developing a microdose formulation that can be used by the general public, but would have major implications for getting people off some of the SSRIs and other drugs that are often prescribed or overprescribed. I do think this is a very rich area of research. I was generally hesitant to get involved with some of these companies, but then I saw the NIH was sponsoring workshops and encouraging investigators to actually do this kind of research. It's like, my university would like steer professors away from anything like CBD related, and then it was like, then they're sending emails to be like, you should be submitting grants to do CBD research. So it's like, the attitudes have changed over time. And I think that we're getting to a point where academic universities will start encouraging their faculty to sort of get involved in this research if federal dollars become available. Of course, it's usually how it works. And I'm excited to get into this research just because I've communicated with people that have used these natural compounds that they're found in nature that seem to be remarkably beneficial and therapeutic for certain disorders.
All right, well,
So yeah, I
fantastic.
think that's another thing on the horizon, and hopefully, in the not so distant future, I can start doing some research in this in the lab, some basic science research, which our lab is very much about moving the science to human application. But for me, as a basic science researcher, I like to see the effects like in model systems and then develop implementation protocols that can be applied to humans. So that's kind of what motivates me a lot, to mechanistically understand how it's working before I apply it. But in the meantime, sometimes I apply it to myself before I actually develop a protocol. It's kind of been the story of my research.
Well, fantastic. I'll have to get you back to talk about all the upcoming research from your lab. But thank you
Like
so
to.
much for your time. It's been wonderful.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Oh, and if people want to learn more about what we're doing,
Yeah.
I'm going to plug my website, ketonutrition.org. So you can go. We don't sell anything. It's just an information website for now. So I encourage people to look at the blog because I go into more in-depth about many of the things I talked about here
And
on
I'll
there.
definitely link to it as well. So it was
Great. Thank
definitely,
you.
it was helpful when I was starting my keto journey. So yeah, I'm
Oh,
sure
thank
it's
you.
going to be helpful
Appreciate
to
that.
people. Hi again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you want to support the creation of the podcast, consider sharing it, leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, or signing up to be a premium member and receive transcripts. You can also donate on Patreon, which is patreon.com/livelongerworld, and connect with me on Twitter, where my handle is livelongerworld. Lastly, all information and resources can be found at livelongerworld.com.